Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Our speaker tonight is Brenda Golianu. Brenda is a longtime member of Canando and a real pillar of our Sangha. She's an ordained priest and a member of the Abbot's Council and has given many wonderful talks to our Sangha. And in her spare time, she's a doctor and a faculty member at the Stanford Medical Center. And thank you, Brenda, for finding the time somehow to prepare a Dharma talk for us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you, Dave. We all have busy lives, don't we? Thank you, everybody. Thank you for coming this evening to our Zoom gathering. So tonight, I'd like to be thinking about how it is that we learn, which is a hobby of mine, to try to understand how we learn and change. And often in our conventional type of learning, such as might be found in school, we're asked to solve a problem or to memorize some fact. And then when comes test time, we are asked to reproduce it, and then we're told whether it's right or wrong. And you know, this can be very difficult if we thought we had it right, or, you know, and it turns out that it was considered wrong. Sometimes we might disagree. But by and large, we try to change our thinking to adapt to the new reality, whether it's right or wrong. And let me try to think that way. Okay. And if we get it right, then we might be very happy. Or if we get it wrong, we might be very dejected or unhappy. And over time, we keep sort of reproducing that pattern. And that might come with varying levels of compensation in our workplace. And we keep trying to get it right. And that's pretty much, I figure, how things go in the regular world. Now, as children, it wasn't always that way. When we're babies or very young toddlers, and here, I've noticed that many of my talks over the past 6 months have involved some story about my grandson. So this will also involve a story about my grandson, William. I apologize for that, for those of you who don't like hearing about children. When we were babies or young toddlers, we are given an unconditional love and attention. You know, during that early period, especially, every sound that comes out of our mouths, you know, is praised by our caregivers. Every movement, you know, if we're lucky enough to have that, every attempt at a step is carefully nurtured and supported and encouraged. Yeah. And somehow with that approach, we're not really told there's no right or wrong. We break something, someone's actually kind of happy we broke it because we moved. And that's a good thing. And somehow with that maybe permissive approach, but very encouraging, unconditional approach, we learn quite a bit in those early years. We learn to speak whatever tongue is spoken to us. We learn to move about, crawl, walk, and negotiate many challenges that come upon a young child. So what changes then? Why does this approach not work later? Why is it not practiced later? I'm not sure, and I'm not even sure it doesn't. I wonder whether there's something in the level of, perhaps in the level of consciousness that the person is bringing to it. What are they trying to accomplish? when they're acting. For example, with the same young toddler grandson, he got bigger, he started walking around, and he's in his twos now. And at one time, he decided that climbing on the table was a good idea during mealtime. And now one might suppose that he knew not to do that. And I think on some level, he did. However, there was a part of him that wanted to know what would happen if he did climb on the table. And his parents' cries and complaints only seemed to make it worse. And certainly did not seem to assuage him from his new hobby. So this was the sign out that I received that day as I started taking care of him. So there we were at mealtime, and on the table he gets. I looked at him, wondering what was going on in that little head. And strangely enough, maybe the grandmother part of me kicked in. I met his eyes, smiled at him, and said gently, "Come on, come down from there." And he snickered to himself, perhaps happy being seen and acknowledged in his newfound power. And he got off the table. And now, perhaps not that much has changed from when we're babies. Being seen and acknowledged is something that we all strive for. Maybe that's all we crave in this strange mixed up world of hybrid workplaces, social media, and transitions after transitions. To be seen and acknowledged in the Zendo or on the Ingawa, we bow to each other when we meet in greeting. And in doing so, something new is created, a new opportunity. Now, maybe that might not work in a busy workplace or at home or while the kids are climbing on the table. It might not always be possible to be patient and understanding. Maybe it might take a different form. A quick text, a dinner brought home, a phone call to an old friend. It may not need to take that much time. Maybe we also need to acknowledge ourselves sometimes, by taking a few minutes out of our day to take the long way home to our car, paying attention to the spring flowers or to the rising and falling of our breaths and of our busy minds. And when we do so, to not feel that we have to name it as right or wrong, but just to see and acknowledge what we find. And when we truly do that, meet ourselves and others, wherever that is, whether in a happy or joyful moment or a sad one, there is a power in that meeting and something new is created. Suzuki Roshi sometimes said that Buddhism is taught from warm hand to warm hand. So I will end there. Thank you very much. Anybody would like to share any questions or stories about learning and what they found helpful or unhelpful? Janet or Dave, I don't know which one. Dave, I think you were first.
Just briefly, I just wanted to say, Brenda, that your charming story about your grandson crawling on the table reminded me of something that I heard recently from Neil deGrasse Tyson. He was talking on TV about the way that parents interact with their children and project a whole sort of value frame on their behavior. And he said in particular, he was looking at his young child years ago, and she took a glass of milk that she was supposed to be drinking, and she was very carefully pouring it onto the top of the table. And he said, his first reaction was, "Oh, don't do that. You're just being a little pill." And his second reaction was, "Wait, look at the way she's looking at it. It's a budding scientist.
Fluid mechanics."
Anyway, it reminded me of that when you talked about, you know, how is it that you look at a child doing things like that?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. It's beautiful. And I think Janet was next. Janet?
I'm thinking what you said about wanting to be acknowledged. And with me, I'm always wanting to be anonymous. So I don't know how that fits in. Maybe I secretly want to be acknowledged. I don't know. That's a curious thing for me.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. That's a good point. I wonder what's with that. It's an interesting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Thank you. Philip?
I was, thank you for your talk. I was thinking that we often say when a child seems to be misbehaving that they're trying to attract attention. And it seemed that like William was attracting attention in that sense, in that pejorative kind of sense, that with his parents. But there was something in the way that you saw him and acknowledged him that gave him more of what he needed. If it's true that a child is looking for attention, that he got something from you that allowed him to be in communication and respond and have a satisfying exchange. It's a lovely story. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. He felt met, you know, he felt like seen. He's like, hey, you see my fancy footwork here.
Were you suggesting, Brenda, too, that we give ourselves attention? Is that what you're...
I did. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I like that. That also rings true. Yeah, it seems that it's very parallel. It doesn't happen.
Yeah, and it's a fine line because we talk about not to extol self, right? We don't want to extol the self, but it's not. I don't mean about extolling yourself. I mean, what I'm meaning is sort of just meeting oneself at where you are, you know, and saying, hey, you know, I'm tired, or hey, I'm sad, or hey, I'm happy, whatever it is, right? Kind of being able to just say, this is what it is. Jaya? Hi.
Hi, Brenda. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Yeah, I was thinking about what Janet said, and I feel the same way sometimes, and I don't know what Janet's thoughts are on that, but and I noticed not just with me, but even in general, sometimes people don't want to be acknowledged, and in the way that we think, you know, you would think, yes, like the child wants to be acknowledged and affirmed. Sometimes that's not the case, or the style, the way in which we do it kind of varies, and it's really hard to judge, I find. You want to give the person space and play and the welcoming kind of an approach when you see the person, but sometimes there's a hesitancy, and I don't know what your thoughts are on how you handle that. You know, there's a reticence that some people carry, and how do you read that and make them feel comfortable and not overwhelmed by your reaching out? So.
What do you think, Janet? Is that to Janet or to me? I'm not.
know. It's just open for discussion.
Open for all of us. I think, you know, we can all be shy in certain scenarios, right? Like somebody can be, you know, can be very confident when you're among friends and, you know, feel very comfortable. And then in the same person could be feel, you know, shy in a different setting when there's, right? I think it depends on the scenario. But it also depends on the person. There's some people that like Janet, and I think sometimes I feel the same way, that, you know, I try to I don't look for the limelight. I just try to quietly just do whatever work, you know, comes to me. But yeah.
Yeah, there's something about, you know, if you take credit for something and get attention and acknowledgement, it doesn't quite count anymore. I mean, you know what I mean? Yeah, it's hard to explain.
Right. If you get praise and credit, then it's kind of diluted somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, but I don't think that's true with kids. I think kids do want attention, and negative attention is almost as good as positive. You know, they just want the attention. So whether you're yelling at them for jumping on the table or saying, okay, you know, it doesn't matter. Just as long as you're noticing, they're fine with that. Yeah. Yeah. So how old is William?
2.5.
2.5. Oh, is he over the terrible twos?
No, he's right in the middle.
He's in the middle. Well, they're lucky to have grandma then.
I was thinking of what you were saying with the milk on the table. It was like we had another experiment where he tried to put a piece of bread in the CD player.
Yep.
You have to admire their creativity. Lee?
I was just thinking about the fact that when we sit in meditation, really, we are beginning to see ourselves, you know, and that's part of what makes meditation so difficult at the beginning. You're coming face to face with who you are, and, you know, as we all know, it's not always what you want to see, you know, and it's that process of, you know, just quietly sitting and beginning to know your own mind is really very interesting. It's like it wakes something up in us too, some awareness that just as a child is made aware when, you know, the people around him or her, you know, notice what they do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you're kind of noticing your habits of mind, your type of thinking, you know, what obsessions you might have of, you know, always coming back to the same topics of thought, you know. So, you know, we're kind of like little children too, when we just sit down and watch our breath and the thoughts that come. So that's kind of a nice, I think, a nice way to look at it, is that we're looking at the child inside each one of us that does want to be seen, but, you know, but really seen and understood. So that was just my two cents on it. Thanks.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point, Lee, because I think that it's, you know, as we grow up, we learn to build these layers of personality, you know, through our education, and so it's very hard to get to the real person, and that person is sometimes, you know, in some ways like a little kid, you know, who just wants to play or wants to experience things and wants to be met. Yeah. Thank you. Philip?
I was thinking about what Lee was saying and really liked that perspective. And it occurred to me that it's kind of like William, if we get too angry at ourselves or critical, that things can, it can become very difficult to sit. I like that analogy and that perspective of just, I don't know, just kind of being there with the difficulties. I'm thinking maybe physical difficulties or just the fact that it may be hard to stay awake or stay kind of a struggle. There are ways to deal with that which aren't as effective as others, and I like the grandmother approach. Thank you.
Les often talks about, you know, maybe I'm paraphrasing you wrong here, Les, so please correct me, but talking about your seeing your problems like a friend, you know, on your shoulder. If you can't concentrate, you know, put that on your shoulder there, let it be there, and you know, treat it like a friend rather than, you know, trying to fight your way. Oh, Umar.
Hi, Brenda.
Hello.
Got me thinking. You know, I used to work at the Stanford bookstore, and it was a two-story store. And people who were going to Stanford, they would bring their two-year-old kids in, and they would be climbing up the ladder stairs one side and coming down the stairs up, and it was just like, and you would see the joy in their faces, in the kids' faces. So like, yay, I just discovered my legs. This is wonderful, you know. Like everything was brand new and everything was joyful for them. It was just like they had a smile on their face. And, you know, parents would be running after them and saying, oh, it's going to fall. And the kid would fall and they wouldn't care. They were all like in their own little zone. And it was just amazing. And so, you know, just watching them reminded me of how much of that we lose. As we grow up, we don't appreciate or don't feel the joy of anything. We just become like, oh, you know, another thing that I have to do. You know, oh, get it over with. No, you know, it's like, look at it, how wonderful it is. How, you know, hold it, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, even, you know, walking into the Zendo sometimes, it's like, hey, slow down. Let's see what happens. You know, curiosity goes away. You know, your grandchild is at a great age, or just discovering all the tactileness of everything, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, lots of experimentation, lots of feeling, and it's just a lot of, I think, body learning is happening, and that's what's happening. But it's amazing. Sometimes just, you know, to sit back and just enjoy the fact that they're, you know, picking something up and looking at it and going, wow, you know. And I think our practice is like that too. I've just started to understand there's a difference between belief and faith. And faith comes from doing, then it comes from, you know, so somebody giving you an idea from the outside and you accept it as your own. Faith comes from when you do something, it goes from inside out, not outside in. And I was thinking, this is what we forget as kids. We come preloaded with the software that says, oh, this is how we do things. Oh, this works this way. This doesn't work this way. And we forget that. And it's just interesting. Sometimes, you know, just sitting in meditation always reminds me of like, oh, we're reinstalling a software. We're going back to our original operating system, and that's what it is. Just like, hey, you know, you get out of the Zendo and you hear the birds and you say, wow, this is amazing sound, you know, just like you hear the litany of the finches go off and it's like, wow, amazing, you know, it's like in the morning, they break the silence, you know, it's amazing. But I was just thinking, you know, that we forget, and this is a good reminder, I think, for you two to see how happy they are, you know, with just discovering of legs and body and movement, and just, you know, it's a good reminder. I think it's something I always felt when I read Suzuki Roshi's book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. He always reminded me of that sort of a thing, that it was just like, oh, going back to like the original operating system, you know, it's like, oh, this is how we do things. We do things and figure things out.
Yeah.
This is what it is. Yeah.
A reboot.
Yeah, reboot sort of. Thank you,
Mark. Dave?
Now, Brenda, this discussion about the way the children look at things, and can we rediscover that, or have we lost it, or at least covered it up? It kind of reminds me, I was just thinking the other day, thinking back, I don't know how many of you were old enough to remember Eric Byrne from the 1960s, wrote a book on transactional psychology. The name of it was Games People Play. To some extent, it was a kind of a, you know, 1960s relabeling of the old Freudian id, ego, and superego. But he basically said each of us has an inner child, an inner adult, and an inner parent. And he talked a lot about the interactions between those, like the way that we superimpose judgmental frameworks on our inner child, the same way that you would do it if your kid was doing something that you think was perverse attention seeking and the kid's being a little monster, but actually that's not necessarily what's going on. Anyway, I just thought that was kind of interesting. It sort of blew up as a big trend in the 1960s to talk about this transactional psychology stuff, and then the whole thing kind of blew over, but I think it went from being overvalued to perhaps being undervalued.
Right. Yeah, I think it's, you know, and then it was followed by the cognitive behavioral therapy, where it's, you know, people do things because of what they believe, and it's kind of like a more of a, what's the word? You know, like we're trying to get a result, you know, and rather than maybe we're acting from a certain state, like a state of mind. You know, so our actions are coming from a certain state of mind. They're not necessarily result driven, but they're, you know, expressions like Umar was saying, hey, you know, I'm happy. I'm going to act in a certain way. Philip?
I was just continuing thinking about an analogy between how we sit and relate to ourselves in sitting, and the parent-child image of William on the table, dancing on the table. And there are some passages in, or some sections in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, that talk about difficult situations when a child is sick, when things are really hard, and the marrow of Zen is one, and that particularly resonates with me. And I was wondering how you, in dealing with William, it seems that it wasn't just a matter of being permissive, like someone who wasn't experienced with children, that there's a structure to how you proceeded. You didn't just say, great, you know, let's see how hard you can kick the sherbo or something. But you said, you smiled and acknowledged him and then asked him to come down. And I found myself thinking about the role of our posture, and Suzuki Roshi in that Marrow of Zen lecture says, when things are really hard, the best thing maybe is just to sit. And even in bad posture and confused mind. And he says that through the strength of the Zazen posture that you've acquired over the years, you'll find the strength to be there with yourself and your problem. Any thoughts on that in terms of either that analogy or not that analogy of that there was some strength and discipline, some structure in how you interacted with your outer child, your outer grandchild?
Well, I definitely have found that to be true. In terms of that sitting and the discipline of sitting can be really, really helpful during difficult times. So I would definitely say yes to that one in the big capital Y. Trying to think of whether, the analogy between that and the kid on the table. I guess I'm thinking it's more like not giving a bad habit undue power. Like, so it's like the, him on the table, he's in a sense that with his folks kind of giving him a hard time and yelling at him was actually just enforcing that. So he was getting that negative attention that Janet mentioned. And I was promising more good attention or better attention if he just got off the table. It's like, come down over here and we'll play, but so in terms of working with ourselves in terms of our posture, sometimes we have to coax ourselves a little bit or cajole ourselves a little bit, say, hey, let's just try this for a little while, even though it's hard. I don't know, maybe other people have other comments about how they work with their difficulties. But I think overall, it's about not working with it head on, like don't, kind of not trying to just make it go away. I think that's the main message, I think. Don't just say, okay, well, it's not okay, you need to go away, because it doesn't. And I think psychologically that's true too. Many psychologists have talked about that. We might wish something would go away, whether it's sadness or pain or confusion, but it generally doesn't go away just because we want it to go away. Because a new situation gradually emerges. Yeah. But I guess the way that new situation emerges is through that acknowledgement. I think that's kind of the crux of it. Is that you have to see it enough to acknowledge it, and then that can shift. Dan?
Hi, Brenda. I missed your talk, but I think I have the gist of it. I recently started working like half time of what I was doing. And when I was working, it was pretty easy to, to not overly focus on desires and so forth. You know, I was so busy that those things didn't come up as much. I mean, I wasn't particularly happy in the job, but much of a lot of things didn't come up. And so in a way, I was able to keep my desires at bay, you know, addictions and other things. I mean, maybe the addiction was work, you know, but a lot of other things didn't arise. And I am finding when I'm with much less work that things are arising. And I think that's kind of curious. And so I just an observation that I'm having now. And and I like the thing what Philip said about giving yourself, actually, maybe you didn't quite put it this way, but being kind to yourself and looking, you know, I deal with children much, much nicer with children than I am with myself. You know, just naturally, right? I mean, you're not going to be mad at a kid, right? But I do all day. Well, not all day, but often I'll say epithets of myself. You know, whether it's verbal or not. And, you know, I like the approach of treating yourself, giving yourself some more kindness than that. I do like that Philip mentioned, from giving yourself more attention, you've mentioned. But I think that would be helpful, particularly as things arise.
Right.
You know, and what Umar said from a curiosity point of view. As it arises, like, oh, okay, look how my leg works, you know. Look how I, you know, look at how I want to take care of that desire, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, go into a habitual activity that is not really beneficial, you know. So anyway, that's my thoughts. I needed to say that.
I think good. I think it's very well said, Dan. I think that's exactly right, you know, and sort of how's that working for you? You know, when you're criticizing yourself and trying to get some change, it's so hard and it's almost made harder, you know, right? Because it's, by the efforting, you know, where if you're kind of can slow it down, and then it actually can flow more.
And slowing it down. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you, everybody.
This talk was brought to you by the Canandoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canandoe.org. That's KANNONDO.ORG.